Okay, hi everyone. Let's kick things off. I'd love to introduce the panel out here, and just to reiterate, this is the Future of Bitcoin panel. Firstly, a huge thank you to Ari, Ken, Chandler, and the entire team over here of volunteers who've done a great job setting up the conference. To start off, we have Neha sitting there in the first seat. Neha is currently the director of the Digital Currency Initiative based at the MIT Media Lab. The Digital Currency Initiative does technology research and development on centralized and decentralized currency, including three developers who work full-time on Bitcoin Core. She's also on the board of Block, which was formerly known as Square. Next, we have John DiAgostino. He is the head of strategy for Coinbase Institutional and the former head of strategy at the New York Mercantile Exchange. He's also the subject of New York Times best-selling books, including Rigged, which is written by Boston author Ben Mezrix. After that, we have Jameson Lopp. Jameson is the co-founder and chief security officer at Casa. It's a service that helps clients create and maintain robust self-custody wallets. He has been building multi-sig wallets since 2015, and he also founded Mensa's Bitcoin Special Interest Group, the Triangle Bitcoin and Business Meetup, and a dozen other open source Bitcoin projects. And lastly, we have Pierre Rochard. He is VP of Research at Riot Platforms. Riot is a publicly listed Bitcoin mining company. He was previously the Bitcoin and Lightning product manager at Kraken, and he co-founded the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute in 2014, which is an excellent repository of Bitcoin and Austrian economics literature, which was actually very helpful for me personally when I went down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin 3 to 4 years ago, and I'd suggest all of you to check it out. So a huge round of applause for all the panelists over here. Thank you all for coming. I'm personally very excited to host this discussion. I'll introduce myself really quickly as well. My name is Chaitanya Jain. Very difficult to pronounce out here in the US, I've realized, so everyone calls me CJ, and that's how I introduce myself. I am currently a first-year MBA student at Harvard Business School. Discovered Bitcoin in 2021, and I've been the crazy Bitcoin guy everywhere since then. And yeah, it's great to be here, and it's a great opportunity to learn a lot from this excellent panel. So to kick things off, we're calling this panel the Future of Bitcoin. And the first thing that comes to mind for everyone is the future of Bitcoin development. So, you know, it would be great to go around and get the thoughts of the panelists on how they think about development for both the Bitcoin protocol and also the larger ecosystem being built on top of Bitcoin, around Bitcoin, and the various trade-offs that you see in the way forward. So to kick things off, Pierre, if you would like to start. And we have three mics, so it'll be good to just keep shuffling it around. Sorry about that.
Yeah, thanks, CJ. I subscribe to the view that the best guide for the future is the past, unless something has really dramatically changed, which I think that since Bitcoin's launch in 2009, nothing has dramatically changed. And so what we've seen over the past is that developers, researchers will propose upgrades to the Bitcoin network, and then that'll go through a very decentralized stakeholder process to see if it actually makes it into activation onto the network. And so we saw the big ones that come to mind are SegWit and Taproot. And so then looking forward, I wish I was as smart as the people who came up with SegWit and Taproot. I'm not. I don't think anybody today knows exactly what will be the next big upgrade, but what I am long on is somebody just one day sending an email to email list and suggesting a big change that everyone will say, oh, why didn't we think of that sooner? And so the creativity and genius of open source developers, I think, is still very vibrant in Bitcoin. Just because we haven't had a slam dunk proposal since Taproot, or just because there's been slow adoption of Taproot, I don't think that has fundamentally changed anything for Bitcoin's future. I think the challenging part, looking outside, is that developers want to have greenfield projects, right? If anyone here, and this is probably not specific to software, but in a lot of other industries, It's a lot more fun to work on something new than to work on something old, right? And so I think that is what attracts a lot of mindshare towards other projects, where working on Bitcoin is very challenging because Satoshi got so much right that there's not a lot left to fiddle with unless you're really familiar with cryptography and you really have some brilliant insights there. Bitcoin's pretty optimized at this point, which might be surprising to hear, but I'll leave it there and pass it to Jameson.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated subject. I would say Bitcoin is challenging because in comparison to all the other crypto networks and protocols, it's very decentralized. It's the oldest one. It has the most value in it, so people are more afraid of screwing up. And really, where we are right now, I think the most important thing is just that we keep seeing people trying. Like Pierre said, like, none of us can sit up here and prognosticate and say this is the direction that it's going to go. And we don't know if, you know, some amazing new proposal that someone has been thinking about for years will suddenly pop up out of nowhere. We are seeing, I think, renewed interest in discussions around some more complicated improvement proposals to the protocol. You know, I won't go down the rabbit hole of all of those, but for me, what I want to see is some sort of protocol change that just makes it easier for people to do second layer development. Because when we have more people that are able to develop on layers that are not the Bitcoin base layer, it's just a lot faster. You don't have to go around asking for consensus from the entire world to implement your changes. You can be much more agile in your software development practices, and you don't have the same level of risk of screwing up $1 trillion worth of value. So amongst all the different proposals out there, the ones that I find most interesting are those that would enable more secure second layers. You could call this like the permissionless two-way peg. Right now, we don't really have any amazing second layers. I would say like the only second layer that is truly permissionless in Bitcoin is Lightning Network. A lot of these other sidechain type things, you end up making security trade-offs, unfortunately.
Okay, sure. So I think this is a really interesting question, and I know that there are a lot of folks out there who want to speak about Bitcoin sort of being done and no longer needing to change, and sort of seeing change as almost a threat model or a threat vector, like a way of sort of causing problems, introducing bugs. I think that's really short-sighted. Bitcoin will need to change in the future. Software is not something that is frozen in time. Software sort of rots almost organically. It is just sort of the nature of how it exists. And so there will need to be bug fixes at the very least. There are things that we know are happening that will need to be addressed in the Bitcoin protocol that right now might probably will require a hard fork in the future. There's breaks in cryptography, so that it's just sort of inevitable that these will happen and will probably need to be addressed. So the idea that Bitcoin's done, I think, is short-sighted. That said, there is a philosophy that has led to Bitcoin's success as being a very credibly neutral place that does not make changes lightly, right? And so I think that philosophy has what has led to its success as sort of being perceived as the new digital gold. And why it's seeing so much institutional attention now and why that attention is sort of, been somewhat blessed by regulators. So it's really interesting to see all these things at play. I think it's helpful to come at this by trying to think about what is the future that you think Bitcoin could best enable, or what is the future that you want to see, right? And I think a lot of us are here because we want to see a future in which money moves in much more efficient ways, where there isn't so much rent seeking, where there isn't so much control over accessibility, where there's more freedom, there's more user sovereignty. And so I think it's always important to keep those things in mind as sort of what we're aiming for. And other people might be aiming for slightly different things. And one of the best things I think about the cryptocurrency space as a whole is that it's this marketplace where you get to test ideas, and anyone can come up with an idea. And it's been really interesting to see that happen in Bitcoin. I was also going to say I was excited about layer two designs like Jameson. And it's been really interesting. I know there was already a panel on this, but it's been really interesting to see those develop and to try to get my head around them and to see what's coming up there. It's quite frustrating in a way, because people are trying to hack around the limitations in Bitcoin in these really amazing ways. Like, they're coming up with these brilliant ideas that are somewhat ridiculous, because if you could just make the small change to the protocol, you wouldn't have to do this crazy, weird, inefficient thing. But it's been really interesting to see those develop and to see them get attention and steam, and to watch things sort of fight out in this marketplace of ideas.
See, that's why I wanted you to go first. You'd say something really clever and give me a great segue. Just be careful when you talk about changing Bitcoin's code. The toxic maxis are going to come at you with pitchforks. That was great. One of the more frustrating things that I've come up against is people misapplying the phrase "code is law" to act as if that means it's immutable in some way, whereas both code and law constantly change. I'm definitely the least technical and probably intelligent person on this panel, so I'm going to stick to my knitting. Just real quick, though, before we do this, is this Chatham House rules? Because I see people filming, which is perfectly fine, but if you film, then I got to be very milquetoast about my answers. So what's the rules here? Okay, but it's Chatham House rules, right? We're not for attribution, or... Okay, well, I'll just be milquetoast then. So what I think, my background is markets, and specifically commodities markets, and I think of Bitcoin as a commodity that can also be used as a currency, just like gold can also be used as a currency, but its primary use case will be store of value and commodity-like attributes. So that's my view. If you think differently, then you're not going to like what I have to say. One of the most exciting things for me is the financialization of this commodity. Because that vastly increases the probability to me that A, it will become geographically and socially fungible, because those are the rails that we're probably going to have, at least in my lifetime, in my kids' lifetime. Maybe everything will change. Maybe the banking system will go away. Maybe that whole intermediary fiat system will collapse. I hope it doesn't. Whenever I hear about people saying it's all going to collapse like happily, I just wonder what the skills they have, because I'm going to be somebody's food in about 15 minutes, and I think most people I speak to in crypto will be somebody's food in 5 minutes. So I hope it doesn't collapse. I hope we find a way to integrate Bitcoin into the modern financial system, and it winds up serving the function of gold, at least in my lifetime, and maybe later on in future generations it can vastly improve on it. But the financialization, the derivatives market that's been built around Bitcoin, I think is amazing, and just in its infancy. So if you think, we used to think about commodities like crude oil, natural gas and gold, we used to think about what we call the derivative multiplier. So if you had a spot market, the physical market for crude oil, let's say, and that could be back, when I was chief strategy officer at NYMEX, that was the largest physical commodities market in the world. And the derivative multiplier, the size of the option and futures market, was about 10 to 30 times that in a given day. And it served a very, very valuable function outside of just speculation. It allowed for, if you don't have that forward curve of derivatives, if you're building a project like a crude oil terminal that your return could take over 10 to 30 years, it's very, very hard to finance that. So if you have this wonderful futures curve that you can go and say, I'll sell 5-year futures against production I don't even have yet, and someone's willing to buy that, i.e. finance your project, you have this wonderful mechanism to build an alternative banking platform, if you will. When I see that being built around Bitcoin, that gives me a lot of encouragement that people will have the willingness and capital to invest in all the really amazing stuff that you guys and smarter people than me will build. So that's the most encouraging thing to me, and I see an increasing financialization of Bitcoin, which to me is a good thing. Like, if you're a maxi purist, it's not a good thing, but I guess I'm more of a practical maxi.
Firstly, I want to say that I want to speak as little as possible, so please feel free to, have a back and forth.
I'll do a back then. because I am a toxic maximalist. I don't think anybody would deny that. I've made very, very minor cosmetic contributions to Bitcoin Core. And so I just want to say that there's... once we start talking about changing the code, it gets really specific about what lines of code are we changing and what are we changing them for. And so I think in principle, and this is probably, I do break from some of the more strong ossification people, that I do think that there have been and there will continue to be improvements to Bitcoin's code base, both within kind of Satoshi Nakamoto's code base of you know, what we call the reference implementation of Bitcoin Core, but also other implementations as well. And that I think the acrimony really gets over externalities, right? Of if we increase the cost of running a Bitcoin node without increasing the benefit, and then we're asking node operators to run that software, that's just a pure cost increase to them, and so they're going to react very negatively to that because you're giving them a bad deal, right? Or you're offering them a bad deal. And so I think that ultimately when we're thinking about code changes, it's, okay, well, is this going to increase Bitcoin's decentralization? Is it going to lower the cost of running a node, make it easier? Or is it going to increase it? And then we have to balance it with other constituencies, let's say, because you have the node operators, but if somebody just wants to transact with Bitcoin, they might not even be running a Bitcoin node, and they want to transact in a way that expresses their views, whether it's by making lots of small payments, right, or onboarding the world and having every merchant accept Bitcoin on chain. And then these two constituencies run into each other, of node operators not wanting to blow up their costs of running a node and making the network centralized versus people who want to use Bitcoin on chain. And that the ultimately the... from the toxic maximalist perspective, we fall in the camp of the node operators. But I grant that the only reason why I personally fall in that camp is because I like the 4 million weight units. I like the 1 megabyte block size limit. I think it's fine. And so if I fell outside of that, then I would, and I know that a lot of folks throughout Bitcoin's history have, you know, had views that that should be increased. Then it becomes very easy to become jaded about, oh, these node operators are you know, not promoting Bitcoin, or they're not advancing Bitcoin adoption, accelerating it fast enough. And so there's going to be a constant tension, and I see it, it's the same way in politics, right? You've got polarity, you've got different people who disagree with each other. What gives me a tremendous amount of hope has been the outcome of that process, which is that here we have a system with zero downtime for the past decade, so tremendous reliability, tremendous security, and adoption continues apace. And then we get into debates of, well, what kind of adoption is the right kind of adoption, right? And so, you know, Jameson earlier was saying that the other layer twos, they're not as decentralized as Lightning Network. You know, if we look at an ETF and we call that a layer three, is it okay to use Bitcoin in a wrapper like that? And we look at Bitcoin's history. Like, look how many people lost Bitcoin on Mt. Gox. People have been putting legal wrappers around Bitcoin for a very long time. And I think that what's really great about the ETF is that it puts a legal wrapper around it that is far more sound than what Mt. Gox was doing, certainly, but that other exchanges, namely FTX recently happened, right? So if we can improve the UX of Bitcoin at every layer, including ones that are not cryptographic, ones that are really, you know, on the policy and legal and institutions dimension, I think that's a positive. I don't think that, and it might relieve some of the tension at the base layer of, hey, if we have people transacting using ETFs off-chain, maybe we don't have so much acrimony at the base layer that is kind of securing the protocol rules and the monetary policy.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is a form of politics, but unlike every other form of politics, it's not a democracy. There is no majority rule. So there are many different stakeholders, and it's interesting to see, like, the markets-based opinion. I don't think we have too many, like, markets-based people come onto the development mailing list and say, hey, like, this would help us. But I think that would be good. Like, we need as much input from as many constituents as possible, because if we want Bitcoin to be a mainstream global phenomenon, then we need to understand that, like, this is not an American-centric thing. It's not even a first-world-centric thing. We're trying, and I hope, because I can only speak for myself, but we are trying to build the optimal form of money. And what does that mean? Well, the only way we can figure out what that means is to get input from as many people as possible, because money is this sort of shared agreement amongst everyone who's using it.
Thank you for that, by the way. I love hanging out with people smarter than me, which is why I got into crypto out of traditional finance. But here's why you need us. Here's why you need guys like me. So I called FTX for years. And not because I'm smarter than anybody else, not because I have any inside information, but if you come from traditional finance, specifically from the exchange world, and I remember being at a conference years ago and kind of just baffled as to why nobody got this. And it's, again, not because I'm smarter than people, just because this is what I lived at the NYMEX. You cannot own the market maker that is setting prices on your own exchange. It was killing me that nobody, I remember being at a conference once, actually being at Sam's conference in the Bahamas, and I'm surprised they didn't escort me off the island. I asked the audience, does anyone know who Ken Griffin is? People in here know who Ken Griffin is? He owns Citadel, the largest market maker in the world, or one of the largest market maker in the world. So I said, okay, raise your hand if you know who Ken Griffin is. They put their hands up like, keep it up if you'd be okay. If we woke up tomorrow and the front page of the New York Times was Ken Griffin, not even Citadel, Ken Griffin buys the New York Stock Exchange. Just he owns it now. Well, everyone kind of laughed and put their hands down. I'm like, but that's what's happening. And there was this bizarre, for everyone in traditional finance, there was this bizarre unwillingness to just acknowledge this elephant in the room of you cannot do both. It doesn't matter what technology you're using. It's a governance issue. It's a pure play governance issue. And so that's the only place I think. Otherwise, I think we should just shut up and listen to the techies. But that is how it is helpful to have us in the room from time to time.
So this is an excellent discussion, and it's great to see like the divergent sort of thoughts that are coming out. One, for me personally, I've learned a lot through just like Bitcoin Twitter, crypto Twitter. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the most recent controversy that's been stirring up for the last 1 week around, let's say, the future of Bitcoin development. So we spoke a lot on the node operator side, the user side, but specifically on the developers itself, there's this controversy recently around the funding of development. And certain ETF issuers are, let's say, giving funds to developers. Certain ETF issuers were going to be giving it, but there's speculation around big names in the industry saying no to that. Would love to get your thoughts on what you see as the vision forward for specifically the development, the funding of developers, if you have any thoughts on that.
I'm not too concerned about it, but this really comes down to whether or not you believe the governance of Bitcoin works in the first place. So my optimistic take is that, you know, because the governance, at least for consensus changes, requires nodes and node operators to opt in to running certain changes, it shouldn't really matter who's proposing changes, because you can't force changes through the system. So while I think the optimal form of funding is through organizations that do no strings attached grants, so that they can basically say, look, you have a good reputation contributing to the ecosystem, we're just gonna pay for your cost of living, pay for equivalent salary, so that you can just work on whatever you want in Bitcoin, help the ecosystem, and we're not gonna try to direct you. I think that's the optimal form. But I'm not against even having private companies pay for developers to make changes, because if they try to shove something through that would only be beneficial to that company, it's just not gonna happen.
Yeah, I just wanna present a slightly different point of view. As someone who's employs Bitcoin developers and has thought a lot about this and has to figure out how to raise money to do that, I'm pretty concerned. But just to be clear, if you don't think Bitcoin needs developers, then this is all moot. So if you aren't bought into that, then that's fine. Everything I'm going to say, you're probably going to disagree with. But if you think that Bitcoin needs developers, and if you would prefer that those developers have some sense of neutrality and independence, then an interesting question is how many developers does it really need, right? I mean, it's a volunteer sort of based thing. People decide they want to get into it. No one's told usually you have to work on Bitcoin Core. That's your job. So it's an interesting question how much you need. But what I've seen is a little bit concerning. I think there are a few places that originate a lot of the funding that goes into Bitcoin development. And if you start to trace all of that back, you end up with a few billionaires who are funding, indirectly a lot of Bitcoin development and developer salaries. Grant-based development, grants have become sort of the most common way for people to get funding. And so what that usually ends up meaning is that people need to work for free, or they need to fund themselves for a while until they can build up enough reputation to get a grant. How these grants are done is, in a distributed way, as it should be. But, are the people who are doling out the grants really the best people to evaluate how contributions are being made? Does it, you know, in my opinion, it kind of leads a little bit towards the loudest people getting the most grants. So if someone's really quiet and is doing work but isn't really being very vocal about that, or that's not well known on crypto Twitter, they might be less likely to get a grant than someone who is very vocal on crypto Twitter about what they're doing. So developers I've talked to have to spend a significant amount of their time thinking about how they are going to literally market the work that they're doing so that they can continue to get grants and to continue to be there. And I don't think developers should have to think about that. A few more things. So in addition to that, they literally choose the work they do by how well it will be perceived by the people doing the grants, meaning will they understand it? Not what's best for Bitcoin in their opinion, but what, you know, is most understandable. In addition to that, I've talked to a lot of senior developers who have just gotten extremely burnt out. And that is not entirely due to the funding process, I will grant you that, though I do think grants play a role in it. It also has to do with the lawsuits that have been happening to Bitcoin developers. So there was a really big lawsuit recently by Craig Wright. It ended very, well, it hasn't ended yet, but the stage it's currently at is very favorable towards the defendants, the Bitcoin developers, but this has been a huge, huge, huge psychological ordeal. There have been people who've left development because of this, who could have been contributing, and, you know, I think that for the current lawsuit, the developers are really lucky because there are a couple people who are willing to fund an organization to pay their legal bills, but that's not a given. There's no foundation in Bitcoin. There was no token sale, which is great. I would not be working on it if there was one. But we have to understand that you know, developers aren't just like magically paid for out of some pot of money. And there's actually, I think the way that it's currently happening is inefficient. I think the most senior talented developers out there don't want to work for grants. They want a stable job, and they want to know that they're going to have that for, you know, years.
What is the argument for Bitcoin doesn't need developers?
I don't make that argument.
No, I'm saying, but does any? I mean, do you know what it is?
Does
do you
anyone
know
on this panel feel that
so,
way?
So okay, so I'll try to make a steel man argument, which is I wouldn't say that it's so much about no developers, because then there have been bugs where, you know, it would just you're. Although, I don't know, this probably gets into a philosophical debate, but I think that if you go back and you run an old version of Bitcoin, it'll still work today.
And it will have serious security vulnerabilities. Don't do that.
Correct, and it'll be very slow. So your node will be consuming more resources than it would have had developers been optimizing the node software. And so I think that from a toxic maximalist perspective, hey, if you've got a change to Bitcoin Core that is going to, you know, reduce initial block download time by 10%, that's fantastic. That's definitely a great outcome from a software engineering perspective and from a user experience perspective. And I think that maybe the steel man is really that, yes, developers should have to market what they're working on, right? And I think that that's true even in a private company, right? If you are a developer in a private company and you're just in your corner working on your thing and you're not communicating about what you're working on, or you're not like selling it up the chain of command to management, then yeah, you might end up getting fired because nobody knows what you're working on and it's not really like cohesive to the unit. But then to another steel man argument, because I generally agree with you, Neha. I'm not. I just want to present the devil's advocate perspective here, which is that I've worked at companies where you hire too many developers, and then they decide that they're going to write a new database from scratch, or they're going to create a new programming language, and they're going to rewrite the whole thing in this new programming language, right? And so, like, Google created Go, Apple created. Microsoft has C#. So you just get enough developers together in a room, and they start writing a compiler. And so you got to be careful about, not wasting resources in a sense. And that's where the other point I'd make is that, yes, there is some degree of independence. But for example, when Riot made a grant to Tobin Harding, our thought process on the grant was, we like what Tobin has been working on, and we want him to continue to work on that. It wasn't that we like Tobin and he can just work on whatever he wants. It's that we actually like what he's intrinsically motivated to do, and so let's help him be able to do that full time. And if he were to change his mind halfway through the grant, I think that there would be some level of sour grapes of, hey, you started working on the next Candy Crush instead of working on Rust Bitcoin libraries. You know, there's misalignment. I think that your last point about them being, you know, on full-time payroll makes a ton of sense. And that's something that I've advocated for internally at, you know, Kraken and at Riot, of that it's different. And that the grant process, so I see the grant process, it should be like an internship that converts into a full-time, right? That, okay, let's do a one-year grant, let's see how it goes. And if you're just so intrinsically motivated that you don't, you know, need to constantly have a carrot dangled in front of you or a stick, depending on how you see it, then they could just be on the payroll and contributing to protocol development.
So I'll tell you what I've been seeing. With regard to like the ossification debate, or we need to stop the developers from, and the word that I see the most often is tinkering. Like, developers like to tinker with things, and we don't want anyone tinkering with our money. I mean, I think that's a valid concern, but I also think nobody's out there really trying to tinker with the properties of the money in a way that would harm Bitcoin holders. But what we're seeing now is, earlier, you know, I referenced that it's very difficult to change Bitcoin because it's a $1 trillion asset. People are very afraid to tinker with it, and rightly so. But I think we're seeing a certain faction of people become almost irrationally afraid, and the thing that comes up the most of what I hear about is the quote-unquote unintended or unforeseen consequences of making changes to the consensus rules in the protocol. And you'll see people specifically refer to the last consensus change with Taproot and how one of the unintended consequences of that was essentially people using that as a new way of essentially data storage. And so creating various tokenization meta protocols, NFTs, you know, non-monetary uses of the Bitcoin protocol. This angered a lot of people who believe that Bitcoin should only be money and nothing else. For me, being a tech purist, I've always seen Bitcoin as a database with a programming language, even though it's highly restrictive in what you can do. That means that, you know, you can come up with other rule sets and other functionality if you want to, because you can use that programming language. But you know, from the ossification perspective, I think, you know, people are afraid of the unintended consequences of change. And the main thing that I've been trying to get across, and I've given several presentations about, is that you need to understand that there are always unintended consequences. There are even unintended consequences of not making changes. And in fact, we have plenty of decades of history of other internet protocols that have suffered unintended consequences because they were ossified. And the rest of the world does not ossify around the protocol. The rest of the world continues changing, and if the protocol cannot adapt and cannot itself make changes for a different environment, then you can run into, you know, unintended consequences there.
I mean, I struggle to understand the level of hubris required, not you, to think that you're going to replace an economic and financial system that dramatically evolved over 600 or 700 years and get it right on the first try. That's pretty extraordinary to me.
You could argue that Bitcoin was far from the first try, but
And I'll also argue that you know, errors. Look, if Bitcoin is an agreement, if it's an agreement on value, we've agreed on value of things that are highly imperfect. The Dow Jones Industrial Index is a mathematically incoherent concept. It doesn't allow for stock splits, for example, but yet that was the standard for a very long time. So I'd argue what matters is, so for example, you made this joke about don't have them doing Candy Crush where they could be doing substantial things. Agree with that, but what if their version of Candy Crush had a Bitcoin micropayment component and that had 10 million more users jump on board, including this awesome kid over there with that really cool hat? I'd argue that's probably maybe better for Bitcoin than a tinker that fixed something, unless it's something really, really important that Neha identified, which in this case we should listen to her and fix it. But yeah, no, I hear that. I hear this argument. I struggle to understand it, given, you know, I started my career when, and I'm not that old, but I started my career when the price of the world's most valuable commodity was set by 868, you know, mostly men back then, screaming and yelling and making hand signals to push out of this building the price of crude oil, and it. I graduated HBS, and my first job, before I became head of strategy, my first job was to hire a C-sharp programmer and try to build a handheld trading app to displace, not the traders, because that was unthinkable. As recently, by the way, this isn't like 1960, this is like 2008. It was just unthinkable that open hour would ever go away. And when you first join as a freshly minted Harvard MBA, you're like, oh, this is insane. Equity and debt markets were already digital. And you sit there, I entered and said, well, I'm going to fix this. This is going to be 6 months from now, we'll be digital. And then you realize how unbelievably well it worked. There were just shockingly few trade breaks and $1 trillion of value flowed through this thing every day. And it just freaking worked. And when you express to the traders, I remember this one old trader pulled me aside. He's like, you know, when he saw the beginning of the end, we were building this handheld trading app to get rid of the pick cards at first. He pulled me aside. He's like, you know, Johnny, he's like, there's a reason the design of the spoon hasn't changed since the caveman times. It effing works. And you can argue that's inertia and corporate and bad corporate, but he wasn't wrong. And to your point about being afraid to swap over a $1 trillion market that's unbelievably important, I kind of get it, but it did have to evolve.
Well, this essentially turns into like a product management type of debate of like, what is Bitcoin optimizing for? Is Bitcoin optimizing for being everything to everyone, for, you know, the largest possible total market size and therefore hopefully the largest possible value? I think that it does that in some ways, but you'll have to understand that unlike pretty much anything else in existence, Bitcoin has an amazing rigid set of constraints and values, and mainly due to the ethos of the people who have been involved in the project and hold a lot of the Bitcoin. And so if you propose something, even if it may theoretically greatly increase the value of Bitcoin, if it's requiring a trade-off that is antithetical to some of those fundamental values, then it's probably going to get shut down. So it seems to me that Bitcoin optimizes for stability and security in terms of the network being as robust as possible, and it does that to the detriment of adoption in a variety of different ways. And for me, I help people, particularly high net worth individuals, get into self-custody and distributed key self-custody. And this has, a fairly large on-chain footprint. Like, it's more expensive to use Casa's setup than it is to do even a single signature, like Trezor Ledger type of setup, much less just a fully custodial setup where you're never even using the blockchain to move your money around.
Yeah. That's fine. Just have them call me.
Yeah, so one of the things that I worry about, like, from a scaling perspective, but also from a security perspective, is where do we end up 10, 20, 50 years from now if the block space becomes so expensive that only millionaires can essentially be sovereign on the blockchain itself? What type of other trade-offs do we end up in? Do we end up in other security models on second, third layers, whatever? And how difficult does it become to even reason about those security models? Because there is no, as far as I can tell, a possible way for second or higher layers to achieve the same level of security as the base layer. There's always going to be some trade-offs.
I'll throw a bomb out there because I think that if the cost of hardware and the efficiency of software is improving over time, then I think that that justifies an increase in the block size limit. And so I think that in that scenario, what we'd see would be a hard fork and an increase in the block size limit, and it would just be self-evident that would be the right thing to do in that scenario. And you've also got the rollout of like fiber and Starlink. I just think that the arguments around resource usage, we've got to dig into more and think about them more in terms of dollar costs or maybe purchasing power, because we don't like the dollar. So per pound of beef, how much Bitcoin node can you run is maybe the metric. But the other point is, at what layer of the stack should folks be focusing on to innovate, right? Is it opcodes on the base layer? Is it improving an existing L2 like the Lightning Network? Or is it creating a consumer-facing application? And that's where your point about micropayments is thought-provoking. Maybe I would tell that developer, hey, don't worry about Bitcoin core development. Go do this consumer-facing app. But it's about expectations of, hey, if I want to fund Bitcoin Core development, that's one thing. If I want to fund VC early stage startups, that's a completely different ballgame. And so that's where we want to make sure, you know, there's alignment.
So we just have 5 minutes left, and I really wanted to get all of your thoughts on. So we've spoken about the monetary use case, and we briefly touched upon the different non-monetary use cases that are coming up. So is there anything in particular that really excites you that you're looking forward to? If you have thoughts on the projects that sort of seem to generate a lot of excitement today, we'll have to sort of go around the table and get your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm going to go first because I mostly think about things that worry me, not things that excite me. So, I don't want to end on that. So, so I'll just say, some of the things I'm thinking about, we didn't really get a chance to go into it, but I think the ETFs are going to be an enormous game changer for Bitcoin in terms of, you know, everything we've been discussing today. The thing you have to realize is none of what we say matters, right? None of us have control over how Bitcoin works. We don't actually get to decide, what kind of node software you should run and you know, how you express your opinion economically in terms of what you buy or don't buy, right? That's the beauty of it. It's this marketplace of ideas. It's this place where, you know, I choose what software I run. I choose what coin I want to buy. I choose my assets. And that's how we determine what Bitcoin is as a shared community. The thing I think you really need to look at is what are the incentives going on inside that. And we've talked about a lot of sort of philosophical opinions about what Bitcoin should be and whether I want the code to change or whether I think things should happen at this layer or that layer. But ultimately, there are going to be economic actors who are expressing their preferences. And right now, there are some massive economic actors that are only going to grow bigger. And those are the issuers of these exchange-traded products, which are holding a lot of Bitcoin. And in addition to that, a lot of that Bitcoin is custodied in one place at Coinbase. So you have these sort of points of large amounts of control in this economic ecosystem that's supposed to be this decentralized, very spread out in terms of control and power sort of system. And I think it's what's really interesting to me is watching and seeing how this is going to develop. Is it going to become even more concentrated? Is there going to be an issue at some point in time where BlackRock wants one thing and the node operators want another thing and the miners want yet another thing? So I think that these things are going to play out. It's going to be really fascinating over the next few years. And it's going to be interesting to see if Bitcoin's sort of current mode of operating continues to be able to push through these things or how that develops.
So I'll continue on the point of financialization. So the most exciting thing for me is the creation of a regulated U.S. accessible options market. So right now that market does exist, but it's mostly non-accessible for U.S. Traders. Why this is important is it goes back to my thesis around I think of Bitcoin as a commodity. So commodities markets function really, really well because you've got the spot and the derivatives market, as I mentioned. The options market, the futures market's great because it creates this nice little curve that you can use to finance stuff. But the options market is kind of where all the action is. Because options behave sort of idiosyncratically when you start to pool them in more advanced ways. And that creates a lot of trading dynamics and just more interest in the market overall. Options also and futures also have implicit leverage, so you can get more for your dollar by investing. They're very, very important for a healthy functioning system. And the one thing that commodities markets have that was always concerned me about Bitcoin, because commodities markets have speculators and hedgers, and you need that for a strong, vital market. If everybody's a hedger, it doesn't work. If everybody's a spec, it doesn't work. You need diversity of reasons for entering a market for a market to be healthy. And the one thing that commodities markets have that Bitcoin didn't until recently, in my view, is they have natural users. They have natural hedgers. So we used to sell to Sara Lee Corporation. They make muffins. So they have to buy a certain amount of natural gas. Or quick version. So we've launched a jet fuel contract. No one would use it. The airlines wouldn't use it. And I remember being on the phone with like one of the big airlines. They're like, well, we don't speculate. I'm like, no, but you do, because you're short jet fuel. You're naturally short. You're speculating. If you use the futures market, you hedge out, you won't be. You won't be speculating. That doesn't exist really. The miners were kind of supposed to be that, but they all hodl, so they don't really do what they're supposed to do. My view. But the ETFs now are that natural user. They have to go into the market. They have to buy. They have to sell, and they have to do it dispassionately. They're not speculating on Bitcoin. The users might be, but the actual ETFs themselves aren't. So now you have this really interesting market dynamic where if you start to track the options market, then every single financial participant and non-financial participant could access this market, and it could grow very, very quickly, even more than it has.
Right, so in terms of protocol changes, like I said, the things that I find most interesting are those that would kind of supercharge layer two development, some of the opcodes that could result in covenants, as they're known. Some of these and even combinations of them are still being explored as to how they could potentially allow people to create, a better type of sidechain. But in terms of reality and like what we can be building right now, rather than speculating on what might happen to the protocol, I'm most interested in security, scalability, and privacy. And so a kind of culmination of all of those would be Chami and Mintz. There's a few projects working on those, like Cashew. And the thing about Chami and Mintz is they have essentially unlimited scalability and nearly perfect privacy, but the trade-off that you make is custodial risk, where the Mint itself could rug pull you and be insolvent and such. And so the kind of the next step beyond that is a project called Fedimint, which is trying to then federate that custodial risk around multiple custodians. And they're even looking and using the Lightning Network to further reduce the kind of silo issues, where right now each Chami and Mint is kind of on its own, so you can only interact with other users of that Mint. But you can actually use the Lightning Network to link all of those Chami and Mints together so that you can now have what I would consider to be a much more robust second layer network.
So you, on the point of hedging, you're right that the Bitcoin miners have not been hedging their future production. And I think, though, it gets back to the conversation about, is Bitcoin a commodity? And so from our perspective, Bitcoin is not a commodity. It's a scarcity. It's not something that we're going to eat or that anybody else is going to eat, but that it's something that is a long-term asset that we want to have on our balance sheet, which doesn't really map to other commodity producers. There are limiting factors, like, for example, operating expense and CapEx, where you do have to sell Bitcoin to cover those. But for the most part, Riot has been accumulating. And what I'm excited about, obviously, is we're building a 1 gigawatt facility just south of Dallas. And so what these grid-scale Bitcoin mining facilities enable is to balance the grid. So quite often, Texas is massively overproducing electricity. Electricity prices are negative in Texas quite often. And then at other times, there's a massive underproduction of electricity in Texas, and we see electricity prices just go, parabolic for an hour or so. And what that's driven by is intermittent renewable generation. So there's been a massive buildup of wind and solar, and we don't control when those are in sync. But Bitcoin mining can help synchronize those two by absorbing load when electricity is being overproduced, and then just curtailing and turning off when electricity is scarce. That way, other users on the grid can have access to it. And so it's been really great to see the development. We've got a facility in Rockdale that's 400 megawatts that's fully operational. And now we're starting to bring online Corsicana. So that's what I'm excited about.
I think Chris Dixon's starting, so everyone's getting antsy to leave.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Chandler, anything you want to mention to the audience?